I lost all of my money, went $400,000 in debt, lost my membership, my job, my board of governor's seat, my executive committee seat, and both of my parents. I lost everything that was important to me except my wife and kids. That was not a good 12 months. I am not relating this story for your pity. I am relating it because it helps convey some important observations I made about the nature of loss. My losses in the market weren't the same as the losses in my personal life. My gambling losses in Las Vegas weren't the same as losses in the markets. All those losses were different from the loss of my parents, which was different from losing my board of governor's seat. Most people acknowledge that losses will happen regardless of the type of business venture. A light bulb manufacturer knows that 2 out of 300 bulbs will break. A fruit dealer knows that 2 out of 100 apples will rot. Losses per se don't bother them. Unexpected losses and losing on balance does. Acknowledging that losses are part of business is one thing. Taking and accepting those losses in the markets is something else entirely. In the markets, people tend to have difficulty actively, as opposed to passively, as in the case of the fruit dealer and bulb manufacturer, taking losses. That is, accepting and controlling losses so that the business venture itself doesn't become a loser. This is because all losses are treated as failure. In every other area of our lives, the word loss has negative connotations. People tend to regard the words loss, wrong, bad, and failure as the same, and win, right, good, and success as the same. For instance, we lose points for wrong answers on tests in school. Likewise, when we lose money in the market, we think we must have been wrong. The American Heritage Dictionary defines lose as 1, to be deprived of through death, and 2, to fail to win, that is, to lose a game, to be defeated. Most of the time, lose or loss is associated with games. Somehow the concepts profit and loss get confused with win and lose and right and wrong. But if you lose as a participant of a game, you weren't wrong. You were defeated. If you lose as a spectator of a game, you must have placed a bet or expressed an opinion on the game's outcome, and you lost money or were wrong, but you were not defeated. External versus internal losses. There are many different types of losses. You can lose your keys, a game or contest, money, your mind, esteem, self-control, your parents, a bet, a job, etc. However, all losses can be categorized either as 1, internal, such as self-control, esteem, love, your mind, or 2, external, such as a bet, a game or contest, money. External losses are objective, and internal losses are subjective. That is, an external loss is not open to subjective individual interpretation. It is an objective fact. On the other hand, an internal loss is defined in terms of the individual, that is, subject, experiencing it. In other words, a loss is objective when it is the same for me, you, and anyone else. The loss is subjective when it differs from one person to another, when it is entirely a personal experience. For instance, thousands of people die every day, but those deaths aren't losses to everyone, only to those who are directly and personally, that is, internally and emotionally, affected. This type of loss is an internal loss and is a function of and created by the feelings and reactions of the person experiencing them. This means the loss is subjective and definable only in terms of the individual experiencing it. On the other hand, when Kentucky loses a basketball game, it is no more of a loss for a member of the losing team than for a spectator in terms of it being an external, objective fact. Both people are totally outside the definition of the event itself. Anyone who was watching the game can tell you which team lost, and everyone watching would tell you the same thing. An objective loss is impervious to how you feel about it or react to it. It's not subject to anyone's appraisal. It must be accepted without evaluation. The player and spectator just mentioned could personalize this external loss if they equated their self-esteem with the success or failure of the team. This would internalize an external loss. Because people tend to regard loss, wrong, bad, and failure as the same thing, it is little wonder that loss is a dirty word in our vocabulary. However, in the markets, losses should be viewed like the light bulbs or rotten fruit mentioned earlier, part of the business and taken with equanimity. Loss is not the same as wrong, and loss is not necessarily bad. For example, consider exiting a losing position with a small loss, but before the loss got bigger. That was a loss, but it was a good decision. By the same token, a profitable trade based on a tip may be bad because of the dangers of following tips. That is, the tipster may have incorrect information, or he doesn't tell you when to get out. Market losses are external, objective losses. It's only when you internalize the loss that it becomes subjective. This involves your ego and causes you to view it in a negative way as a failure, something that is wrong or bad. Since psychology deals with your ego, if you can eliminate ego from the decision-making process, you can begin to control the losses caused by psychological factors. The trick to preventing market losses from becoming internal losses is to understand how it happens and then avoid those processes. How market losses become internal losses. The key to understanding how external losses become internalized lies in knowing the subtle differences between facts and opinions. The American Heritage Dictionary defines a fact as something that has been objectively verified. Facts are neither right nor wrong, they simply are. Opinions are personal assessments and are right or wrong depending on whether they actually correspond with the facts. Therefore, only opinions can be right or wrong. Facts cannot. Right and wrong are inappropriate for the description of business operations and market participation, and so are the terms win and lose. Participating in markets is not about being right or wrong, nor is it about defeat. It's about making decisions. Decision-making is a process of reaching a conclusion after careful consideration. It is a judgment, a choice between alternatives when all the facts are not yet and cannot yet be known because they depend on events unfolding in the future. Therefore, decision-making is not a choice between right and wrong. In 2020 hindsight, decisions might be good or bad, but not right or wrong. With regard to the markets, only expressed opinions can be right or wrong. Market positions are either profitable or unprofitable. Period. But due to the vocabulary quirks outlined above, it is easy to equate losing money in the market with being wrong. In doing so, you take what had been a decision about money, external, and make it a matter of reputation and pride, internal. This is how your ego gets involved in the position. You begin to take the market personally, which takes the loss from being objective to being subjective. It is no longer a loss of money, but a personal loss to you. That is, someone you knew was on the airplane that crashed. An example of personalizing market positions is people's tendency to exit profitable positions and keep unprofitable positions. It's as if profits and losses were a reflection of their intelligence or self-worth. If they take the loss, it will make them feel stupid or wrong. They confuse net worth with self-worth. The very use of the terms right and wrong when describing a market position or business dealing means, one, an opinion has been expressed, which only a person can do. 2, the market position or business venture has been personalized. And 3, any losses or successes are going to be internalized. Remember when I described the high from being right about the market on my $248,000 day? I had just made all that money for me and everyone else. I was so smart. I didn't know it at the time, but the only thing I had done was completely personalize my position in the market. The 5 stages of internal loss. It may seem a bit strange comparing the loss of life to a loss in the market. Ordinarily, you wouldn't think of a loss in the market as a life or death situation. Although living through $1.5 million loss can sure make you think about the alternative. However, the stages people go through when experiencing a loss in the market are strikingly similar to the stages people go through when facing death. When my father was dying, a friend of mine gave me a book about people with terminal illnesses titled On Death and Dying by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. During interviews with 200 terminally ill patients, the author identified 5 stages terminally ill patients go through once they find out about their illness. One can see the same stages in most people facing personally tragic news, such as the death of a spouse or a child. I also think people experiencing any type of internal loss go through these stages. For the purposes of this book, let's refer to them as the 5 stages of internal loss. Below is a brief description of each stage and a reference to how I displayed the same characteristics when I was in the bean oil trade. 1. Denial. Upon receiving the news of being terminally ill, patients immediately responded, "No, not me. It can't be true." Some patients were observed shopping around for many doctors looking for reassuring second opinions. Patients discounted doctors' opinions that confirmed the original diagnosis and emphasized those that were more optimistic. This is the same thing I was doing in September and October of 1983 when the bean oil position stopped going up and started down. I was losing money but denied that the market had really turned around. I was indignant. That was the trade that was going to make me $10 million, remember? In October, I knew that I was underwater, but didn't even know how far under I was. That is the personification of denial. If you can't even or don't dare sit down and calculate how much you're losing in a position, but you know to the exact penny how much you're making on your profitable positions, then you're denying the loss. I also sought second opinions by asking other traders what they thought about the market. And, of course, I listened to the ones who were bullish and ignored those who weren't. 2. Anger. When the denial stage cannot be maintained any longer, it is replaced with feelings of anger, for example, rage, envy, resentment. The anger is displaced in all directions, for example, nurse, family, doctor, treatment, and projected onto the environment at random. I vented a lot of my frustrations about the loss in the form of anger directed mainly at my family. For a while, Pat and the kids avoided me like the plague. 3. Bargaining. Unable to face facts in the first stage and angry at people and God in the second stage, patients try to succeed in entering some sort of agreement that may postpone the inevitable from happening. If God has decided to take me from this earth and he did not respond to my angry pleas, he may be more favorable if I ask nicely. In September 1983, I made a pact with myself that if the market rallied back to where it had been in late August, I'd get out of the position. By November, I was begging the market just to get my position back to break even. All I wanted to do was get back to where I was before I had put on the bean oil trade. 4. Depression. Depression is a complex psychological disorder, and discussing it at length is beyond the scope of this book. Generally speaking, however, some of the symptoms of depression are pervasive feelings of sadness, distancing yourself from loved ones, changes in appetite or sleep habits, loss of energy, inability to concentrate, indecisiveness, and refusal to follow advice. While I never went to a doctor to see if I was clinically depressed, I had a lot of these symptoms in the fall of 1983. I was so consumed with the bean oil position that I couldn't sleep through the night, skipped meals, lost 15 pounds in 4 weeks, and lost interest in all the things that I once had found enjoyable. I was constantly tired, couldn't focus on my work, and refused the advice of those who told me to get out of the market. 5. Acceptance. The patient finally resigns himself to the inevitable. In this stage, communication becomes more nonverbal. Kubler-Ross says acceptance is almost void of any feelings and is marked by resignation. There are patients who fight to the end, who struggle and keep a hope that makes it almost impossible to reach the stage of acceptance. The harder the struggle to avoid the inevitable death, and the more they try to deny it, the more difficult it will be for them to reach this final stage. But they do finally reach this stage. Similarly, the traitor finally faces up to the inescapable reality and accepts the loss, either because he wakes up and does something to get out of the position, or, more likely, because someone or something else forces him to exit the position. In my case, it was the latter. Without force, I never would have accepted, nor taken, the loss. For terminally ill patients, the one thing that usually persists through all these stages is hope. Even the most accepting patients left open the possibility for some cure, the discovery of a new drug or last-minute success in a research project. They showed the greatest confidence in the doctors who allowed for such hope and appreciated it when hope was offered in spite of bad news. This is the same hope I was relying on when the bean oil position was deteriorating. When I talked to other traders, I only paid attention to the opinions and the news that confirmed my position in the market. The 5 stages of internal loss and the market participant. Once a person has personalized a market position and it starts to show a loss, he is uncertain when or how it is going to end, just like the person with the terminal illness is uncertain what's coming next, and he goes through the 5 stages of internal loss. He denies it's a loss. No way! Is the market really down there? Are you sure that's not a misprint? It's a profitable trade that just hasn't gone his way yet. He gets angry at his broker or his spouse or the market. After that, he starts bargaining with God or the market that if he can only get back to break even, he will get out of the position. Then he gets depressed about the losing position. Finally, acceptance comes either because he wakes up, the analyst finally puts out a sell recommendation, or the margin clerk blows him out of the position. The market participant doesn't have to move directly to the acceptance stage. He can loop back to denial after each and every temporary reprieve the market gives him. If the market rallies some, he thinks the market has finally turned. But when the market starts back down again, he slips back into denial, then anger, and so on. With each temporary rally, he has another opportunity to play out the stages and lose more money in the process. Even if the position is a net profit, the trader or investor can go through the 5 stages. Consider when a market position is profitable, but not as profitable as it once was. When that happens, he becomes married to the price at which it was the most profitable. He denies that the move is over, gets angry when the market starts to sell off, makes a bargain that he'll get out if the market moves back to that arbitrary point, gets depressed that he didn't get out, and maybe even lets the profit turn into a loss, thus slipping again into denial, then anger, etc. He creates a chain reaction of loops that result in further losses. This is exactly what I did in the bean oil trade. Every time the market rallied, I felt relieved and assumed that the decline was over. Having survived each downdraft, I would start looking at the market as though I had just entered the position, and I would create new levels and parameters with which to monitor the market. Discrete events versus continuous processes. Earlier in the chapter, we saw that someone could actually internalize an external loss. The player or spectator could take the loss of the game as a personal matter and internalize what is properly an external loss. Although someone could do it, it's a little hard to imagine someone going through the stages of denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance over a basketball game. Why? Because the game is a discrete event, an activity with a defined ending point. However, internalizing an external loss is a lot easier to do with the other type of loss-producing activity, a continuous process, an activity that has no clearly defined end. Losses from continuous processes are much more prone to become internalized because, like all internal losses, there is no predetermined ending point. In a continuous process, the participant gets to continuously make and remake decisions that can affect how much money he makes or loses. On the other hand, a discrete event, for example, a football game, roulette, blackjack or other casino game, has a defined ending point, which is characteristic of external losses. A loss resulting from a discrete event is definitive and not open to interpretation. When I bet on a Kentucky basketball game and Kentucky loses, it is a discrete event and an external loss that I can't really argue with. Or if I bet on 21 red in roulette and the ball lands on 17 black, I lost. Period. The markets fall into the category of continuous process because market positions have no predetermined ending point. Granted, the market has a defined open and close for the day, but a market position continues beyond the market's close and could go on forever. Even though a loss in the market is an external loss, since money is external, not internal, it is also the result of a continuous process and prone to becoming an internal loss. Why? In a continuous process, there is no certainty of how or when the open market position will end. That uncertainty about the future triggers the five stages of internal loss, which means the loss has become internalized, personalized, and subjective. Because a losing market position is a continuous process, nothing forces you to acknowledge it as a loss. There's just you, your money, and the market as a silent thief. So as long as your money holds out, you can continue to kid yourself that the position is a winner that just hasn't gone your way yet. The position may be losing money, but you tell yourself it's not a loss because you haven't closed the position yet. This is especially true for stock market positions because when you own the stock outright, no margin call is going to force you to call a loss a loss. Think of the differences between discrete events and continuous processes this way. Would you lose more money or less money at the racetrack if they stopped the race in the middle and reopened the betting window? That is to say, if you had the opportunity to either 1. Leave your bet or 2. Make a second bet on another horse. You sat down before the race, looked at the racing form and said, "Okay, number 4 is obviously the class horse, but he's 3-2 and I'm not going to bet the favorite because there's not enough payoff. I kind of like number 7 and he's 5-3, but 9 looks okay and he's 7-1. I'll go with 9. Halfway through the race, who's in front? Number 7. If they could stop the race and let you bet again, what would you do? You would say, "I knew it! I liked 7 to begin with. I should have picked 7. You would go to the betting window and make a new bet on number 7. Who wins? Number 4. In the markets, they never close the window. It's open all the time, so you continuously get to remake that decision and constantly make new bets. When I was in Cleveland managing the office for Jack Salmon's regional firm, I had an experience that demonstrates this concept of internalizing external losses. One time, a lot of my customers got short the lumber market. They were big cash lumber hedgers and knew that market as well as anybody. Their analysis, and mine too, was that the market was overpriced and due for a fall. So we got short. Well, the market rallied sharply. The market opened limit up and stayed limit up for 4 days in a row. There was no trading in the futures, so we couldn't get out of our shorts. On the fifth day, the market started to trade, but we didn't get out. We wanted to watch the market to see if it would start back down. Well, it didn't. After a few more days of the market trading during the day but closing limit up, we all got out of our shorts. God, it was awful. It had wiped out 90% of the office equity run. I called Jack Salmon down in St. Louis. Look, I just blew up the office. There is no more money, no more business. It's all gone. I've destroyed it. What happened? We were short lumber and the market kept going up and, well, whose idea was the trade? It was the customer's idea, but, okay, how many lawsuits do we have? We don't have any lawsuits. These guys are good guys. They're not going to sue anybody. But how many debits do we have? We don't have any debits. Don't you understand? We lost all the money. Wait a minute. Let me see if I understand this. We have no lawsuits, no debits, and no customer complaints. Right. Well, that just means you've got to go back to work, boy. You've got to pick up the phone again. This is part of the business. This is part of the deal. People get on the wrong side of the market and they lose all their money. Then the broker has to decide, do I want to stay in the business or get out of the business? Want to get out? Get out. Want to stay in? You don't have any problems. You just have to go back to work. Not only had I failed to see that losses were just part of the business, but I had gone so far as to personalize someone else's losses. If only I had known then what I'm writing now. Seven. The psychological fallacies of risk. Most people who think they are investing are speculating, and most people who think they are speculating are gambling. Unknown. One day in the summer of 1981, my partner Larry Broderick and I met in Las Vegas with one of our best customers, Conrad Panette, a French-Canadian and the manager of a very large lumber company in Canada. He was very wealthy and a big baccarat player. We got to Vegas and checked into the Hilton, since that's where Conrad liked to stay. This was the first trip to the Las Vegas Hilton for Larry and me, and they didn't know us from Adam's off ox, but they knew Conrad. He was a very big player, and they loved him. All they want in Vegas is a guy who will play, and Conrad would play. We met Conrad in the hotel lobby, and the first thing he said was, "What kind of a line do you boys want?" I said, "I don't know. Well, why don't I just get you set up for $10,000? $10,000? I really didn't want to lose $10,000. "Ah, we'll just set you up with a line. Don't worry about it." So when I got to the casino, all I had to do was sign a piece of paper, and they gave me $2,000 or $3,000 in chips. I just signed, and they gave me chips. "Hey, this is kind of neat," I thought to myself. "It's not like I even had to have the money." Conrad wanted to warm up before going to play baccarat. His warm-up was to sit down at a blackjack table with a $50 minimum bet. Now, this was at a time when I might have been trading 20 or 30 or 40 contracts at a crack as a local trader. On 20 contracts, I might be making or losing $1,000, $3,000, or even $5,000 in an hour in the pit. Serious money. So in context, $50 blackjack wasn't a lot of money. But when I sat down at that table, $50 sure seemed like an awful lot of money. I said to myself, "What am I doing betting $50? This is nuts." But he was the customer, and Larry and I wanted to make him happy. Well, in half an hour I was down about $500 playing warm-up. I said, "Ah, this is not good. I'm not having fun here. I've had it with this warm-up stuff. Let's go try this Baccarat thing." Baccarat was neat. It's been a game for the rich in France and Italy since the 15th century. I was rich in 1981, so I wanted to play. In the casinos, it's always off to the side. It's roped off, and they have to unfasten a velvet rope to let you in. It's where the big guys play. The riffraff was out there throwing craps and playing roulette, and the big boys were in here at the fancy table where the waitresses catered to you and got you anything you wanted to drink. They served you brand-name drinks at the Baccarat table. I liked that. A guy met us at the velvet rope and said, "Mr. Panette, Mr. Paul, Mr. Broderick, we're glad to have you." We sat down and signed a little piece of paper, and the guy shoved a whole bunch of chips in front of us. I had never played Baccarat before, but I'd read about it in the James Bond book, Goldfinger. The first thing you learn about Baccarat is that there really are no decisions to make other than which way to bet, player, house, or tie, and how much to bet. In blackjack, you're making choices. Do you want a card or not? In addition to how much you want to bet. In Baccarat, there are no decisions about the cards. The rules make all the decisions. The game is determined entirely by chance. The dealer deals two cards to the two sides, house and player, and the rules dictate whether or not a third card is drawn. The object of the game is to draw cards adding to nine. Tens and face cards count as zero. The dealer makes sure the bettors follow the inflexible rules. The strategy of Baccarat players is similar to what traders use in the markets. They look for trends. The players get a little scorecard. Across the top it says house, player, and tie, and it has columns under the headings. After every hand, they put a little X under the appropriate heading, depending on who won. What they're looking for is a run of wins by either the house or player. So if the house wins three straight hands, for instance, they will bet on the house on the fourth hand. Conrad was explaining all this stuff, most of which made little sense to me. But he was the hotshot gambler and supposedly knew what he was doing. So I started playing the look for the run routine and betting the minimum $25. Well, somewhere along the line, I was down about $2,000 with this Mickey Mouse looking for runs. I was getting very bored and more than a little upset. $2,000 is real money. I don't know what else I would have done with $2,000, but I can think of a lot of things I could have done, like bought two pairs of Lucchese boots or a new shotgun. Well, at about 3 o'clock in the morning, we got a new dealer and a new dealing shoe. The first two hands in the new shoe came up player. Conrad looked at us and said, "Guys, this is it. I feel it. This is it. We're gonna get a run." So he doubled his bet. He was betting $100 or $200 at a crack. I still bet my $25 and we bet on player. Player won the third hand. I left the $50. Player won again. I left the $100. Player won again. Well, before the run ended, player had won 16 straight hands. Luckily for us, somewhere around the 10th or 11th hand, we started taking some money off of the table and lowering our bets. Conrad made about $40,000. Broderick and I each made about $7,000. Now it was 4 o'clock in the morning in Las Vegas, and we had all this free money that had just shown up out of the sky. You can get into a lot of trouble in Las Vegas with that much free money that you don't need, didn't expect to have, and don't care if you have the next day. Life is fraught with risk. Crossing the street is a risk. Driving a car is a risk. Getting married is a risk. And so is having children. Needless to say, starting and operating a business is a risk, and so is participating in the markets. Risk is defined as the possibility of suffering a loss. It's called probability only if you can assign a numerical value to the likelihood of the loss occurring. In none of life's activities is there a guarantee of success or of having things turn out the way you want. Obviously, the types of risk we are interested in are financial in nature, risk that produces monetary losses. Most people don't know whether they are investing, speculating, or gambling, and to the untrained eye, the activities are very similar. Looking back on my trip to Vegas, I can see the similarity between the casino and the brokerage house. The brokers are the croupiers. The commissions are similar to the house percentage. The boardrooms are the casinos themselves. The stock exchange and the ticker tape are the gambling devices. However, the markets and gambling games are similar only in that they each involve the possibility of monetary loss. They are different not only in the legal sense, but also in the economic sense. The big difference is gambling creates risk while investing, speculating, assumes and manages risk that already exists. Inherent risk. Inherent risk is a natural occurrence in both unorganized markets and organized markets. Management guru Peter Drucker calls it risk which is coincident with the commitment of present resources to future expectations. Unorganized markets are the everyday markets in which we participate as consumers, such as the department store, the grocery store, and the gas station. The producers bear the financial risks associated with getting the product to the consumer. Organized markets, on the other hand, are the centralized exchanges and over-the-counter markets for stocks, bonds, currencies, options, and futures contracts. Created risk. Created risk involves the arbitrary invention of a potential monetary loss that otherwise would not have existed. Created risk is risk that is not a natural byproduct of an activity itself. The roulette wheel could be spun, the football game played, and the horse race run without monetary loss occurring. Generally speaking, that's as far as people distinguish between inherent and created risk. However, a closer examination reveals that what determines whether someone is engaging in created or inherent risk is not the activity itself, but the characteristics the person exhibits when engaging in the activity. Let's define what those five activities are and the characteristics associated with each. 1. Investing is parting with capital in the expectation of safety of principal and an adequate return on the capital in the form of dividends, interest, or rent. Since the return on capital takes the form of periodic payments of interest or dividends, investing indicates an intention to be separated from the capital for an extended period of time. Therefore, investing is usually associated with relatively long time horizon. Buying stocks in a pension fund with the intention of holding them indefinitely, or buying bonds with the intention of holding until maturity, is investing. 2. Trading is basically an activity in which someone, usually called a dealer, makes a market in a given financial instrument. Traders try to extract the bid-ask spread from a market. An example of a trader is the specialist on the floor of a stock exchange. He matches orders, maintains an orderly market, and is willing to buy at the bid and sell at the offer. Traders on the futures and options exchanges make two-sided markets, trying to buy at the bid and sell at the offer. Traders in the over-the-counter stock and bond markets do the same thing. In its most basic definition, trading is market making. The trader essentially tries to stay net flat, neither long nor short, and make money by extracting the bid-ask spread. In this sense, Stu Gimbel, my friend from the lumber and eurodollar pits, was the consummate mechanical trader. 3. Speculating, in its simplest form, is buying for resale rather than for use or income, as is the case for commodities or financial instruments, respectively. Speculating is parting with capital in the expectation of capital appreciation. This capital appreciation is the sole extent of return for the speculator. He does not anticipate return in the form of periodic dividends or interest payments because he does not intend to hold the position for an extended period of time. The word speculation is derived from the Latin word specere, which means to see. Speculating means vision, perception, the faculty of intellectual examination. 4. Betting is an agreement between two parties where the party proved wrong about the outcome of an uncertain event will forfeit a stipulated thing or sum to the other party. Therefore, a bet is about being right or wrong. For example, people bet on the result of an election or a football game. More often than not, they bet on whom they want to win rather than on whom they think will win. I always bet on Kentucky in basketball games. If I took into account the point spread, that would be speculating. If I had been a bookie taking bets either way, trying to keep my exposure even and extracting my commission, I would have been more like a trader who tries to stay net flat and extracts the bid-ask spread. 5. Gambling is a derivative of betting. To gamble is to wager money on the outcome of a game, contest, or event, or to play a game of chance for money or other stakes. Gambling usually involves a game or event of chance. Sometimes it involves games of both skill and chance. While gambling is popularly regarded as a vice that is injurious to public morals, it is actually a form of entertainment. Compulsive gambling might be injurious, but so is compulsive behavior of any kind. Gamblers may make money, but they are not deprived of enjoyment or entertainment if they do not make money. Individuals who lose a couple of $100 in casinos are paying an entertainment fee, and they know it and have decided it's worth it. They engage in the activity for the action and the excitement of participation. Behavioral characteristics determine the activity. Don't make the mistake of assuming that just because you're participating in the market, you are automatically investing, trading, or speculating. The markets don't make you immune from betting or gambling. Determining which of the five activities you are doing is a function of the behavioral characteristics you exhibit. Gambling, investing, and trading are not defined by any particular activity itself. That is, playing cards, buying stocks, or trading futures, but by how the person approaches the activity. All card playing is not gambling, all stock purchases are not investing, and all futures transactions are not trading. Gambling and betting are most often associated with contests or games, such as casino games, sports games, horse racing, slot machines, and bingo, to name a few. Bettors and gamblers can be either spectators or participants in the event on which they wager, but the distinguishing characteristic of a bettor or a gambler is whether he wants the satisfaction of being right in his prediction or the entertainment of participating, respectively. The bettor is interested in being right. His ego is on the line. He has a stalwart fealty to the team, a market position, or an opinion. Very often, market analysts are subject to this pitfall. Having expressed an opinion either on market direction or the value of a particular stock, it becomes difficult, if not impossible, to abandon that opinion. The analyst doesn't want to be wrong or look stupid. He wants to be right. He is betting. The immediate aim of gambling is to entertain, betting for excitement. People gamble to escape the humdrum of everyday life. It fulfills the desire for stimulus, for example, increased adrenaline and a rise in blood pressure, replacing the painful boredom of everyday life with thrill or excitement. The distinguishing feature of gambling is that it deals with the unknown. with pure chance. Money is only the ticket to this game, and therefore winning or losing is relatively unimportant. It's the excitement that's important in gambling, the way right and wrong are important in betting, the way money is important in investing, trading, and speculating. In gambling, winning is desired only in that money is needed to enter the game or continue playing. Money is good for only one thing, and that is to gamble. Conventional gambling serves no purposes other than those common to other forms of play. The gambler isn't playing a game, he is just playing. To a gambler, all normal criteria of odds, respective return, probability of winning, etc., are irrelevant. At the poker table, you always see some guy who stays in every hand, going for the inside straight even though the odds are he's not going to hit it. In a best-case situation, the odds are 12 to 1 against him and deteriorate from there if one of the cards he needs has already been played or is in another player's hand. When I was in Las Vegas with Larry and Conrad, I saw gamblers at the roulette table just throwing money away. But they didn't care. They were interested in entertainment and excitement, not money. It is important to understand that not all participants in gambling games are gamblers. The aim of the professional gambler, as he is called, is to make money. He can be recognized by deliberate and extremely disciplined wagering. His wagering is systematic and usually limited to infrequent but highly favorable opportunities. The behavior of the professional gambler is highly controlled and usually the result of a studied approach to his chosen game. He concentrates on games where the element of skill is sufficient to produce the possibility of a player advantage, such as blackjack and parimutuel betting. The professional gambler is similar to the stock arbitrager in that they both take calculated risks. They are dealing with an uncertain outcome and seek to profit from their ability to anticipate the future or to see the future. In other words, to speculate. Professional gamblers are actually speculators because of the characteristics they exhibit when risking money. They are not seeking entertainment at the tables like gamblers do. They are not trying to be right. They are trying to make money. Consider Edward O. Thorpe, the author of Beat the Dealer and a mathematics professor who devised a winning card counting system on a high-speed computer. He won so much money in Las Vegas playing blackjack that the Vegas Resort Hotel Association changed the rules of the game. Thorpe wasn't gambling, even though he was playing cards. He was a professional speculator. Or consider a story reported in Business Week about an entrepreneur who started a small service company, took it public, made $20 million, and then turned around and lost it in another business venture. He said, "The relationship between gambling and entrepreneurship was an uneasy one," and confessed to behaving like a gambler in a business enterprise. This guy wasn't speculating on a business venture. He was gambling, and fell prey to gambler's ruin. That is, he wagered it all on that one venture, just as I had wagered disproportionately on the bean oil trade. If a person approaches a business risk or a risk in the financial markets for excitement, then he is gambling, regardless of how much control he supposedly has over the outcome. If you can find speculators in casinos, then you can also find gamblers and bettors in the stock and commodity markets, either as customers, brokers, or analysts. Whether they are betting or gambling is a function of how they go about participating in the markets. Are they exhibiting the characteristics of a bettor or gambler? If so, then they are betting or gambling, regardless of what they think they are doing or say they are doing. A dangerous combination. As the epigraph to this chapter indicates, most people don't know whether they are engaging in inherent or created risk activities. Couple this with people's failure to distinguish between the two types of loss-producing events, continuous and discrete, introduced at the end of the last chapter, and you have a disaster waiting to happen. Recall that in discrete events, such as gambling and betting games, there is a defined end to the risk activity. But inherent risk activities are continuous processes with no predetermined end. For instance, running a business keeps you continuously exposed to the risks coincident with the commitment of resources to future expectations. A single sales transaction may be a defined event with a beginning and an end, but the business operation itself is a continuous process. Likewise, a market position is a continuous process, which introduces the possibility of internal losses because of the uncertainty of when the process will end. On the other hand, created risk activities are associated with discrete events, such as sports games, political contests, or the rolls of the dice. The game ends, the contest finishes, and the dice stop rolling. Betting and gambling are suitable for discrete events, but not for continuous processes. If you introduce the behavioral characteristics of betting or gambling into a continuous process, you are leaving yourself open to enormous losses. In betting and gambling games, you wager and wait to see if you are right or to experience some excitement, respectively. Any resulting monetary losses are real, but they are also passive because the discrete event ends all by itself. On the other hand, a position in the market is a continuous process that doesn't end until you make it end. If you wager and wait in the market, you can lose a lot of money. In betting and gambling games, if you stop acting and do nothing, the losses will stop. But when investing, trading, or speculating, if you're losing and stop acting, the losses don't stop. They can continue to grow almost indefinitely. Psychological fallacies. We've already seen that everyday life involves risk. Likewise, estimating and managing those risks is a necessary part of everyday life. Probability is the mathematics of estimating risk. And you know how I feel about math. I'm not going into a long dissertation on the subject. I am, however, going to point out some of the more common misunderstandings about probability and how we psychologically distort situations to make the odds seem more in our favor. In this section, I want to point out a few examples of the fallacies in popularly held beliefs about probability and how market participants apply the same fallacies to their market strategies and positions. Succumbing to the fallacies is harmful enough when applied to discrete events, but it is catastrophic when applied to continuous processes. Below are a few examples of the psychological fallacies most people have when it comes to risk and probability. 1. The first psychological fallacy is the tendency to overvalue wagers involving a low probability of a high gain and to undervalue wagers involving a relatively high probability of low gain. The best examples are the favorites and the long shots at racetracks. 2. The second is a tendency to interpret the probability of successive independent events as additive rather than multiplicative. In other words, people view the chance of throwing a given number on a die to be twice as large with two throws as it is with a single throw, like throwing sixes four times in a row in craps and thinking that must mean their chances of throwing a seven next have improved. 3. The third is the belief that after a run of successes, a failure is mathematically inevitable, and vice versa. This is known as the Monte Carlo fallacy. A person can throw double sixes in craps 10 times in a row and not violate any laws of probability, because each of the throws is independent of all others. 4. Fourth is the perception that the psychological probability of the occurrence of an event exceeds the mathematical probability if the event is favorable, and vice versa. For example, the probability of success of drawing the winning ticket in the lottery and the probability of being killed by lightning may both be 1 in 10,000. Yet from a personal viewpoint, buying the winning lottery ticket is considered much more probable than getting hit by lightning. 5. Fifth is people's tendency to overestimate the frequency of the occurrence of infrequent events and to underestimate that of comparatively frequent ones after observing a series of randomly generated events of different kinds with an interest in the frequency with which each kind of event occurs. Thus, they remember the streaks in a long series of wins and losses and tend to minimize the number of short-term runs. 6. Sixth is people's tendency to confuse the occurrence of unusual events with the occurrence of low-probability events. For example, the remarkable feature of a bridge hand of 13 spades is its apparent regularity, not its rarity. All hands are equally probable. As another example, if one holds a number close to the winning number in a lottery, he tends to feel that a terrible bad stroke of misfortune has caused him just to miss the prize. Some examples. Independent events. A dealing shoe in baccarat doesn't know anything about what cards have already been dealt. Cards coming out of a deck are statistically independent events. In fact, one might argue that according to the law of large numbers, each side has a 50-50 probability of winning, and one should bet against the run in baccarat. Nevertheless, people bet in baccarat on the premise that the random events of drawing cards from a dealing shoe are somehow related to one another and will tend to create a string of runs. Risk, exposure, and probability. The definition of risk is to expose to the chance or possibility of loss. Most people erroneously try to assign a numerical value to that chance, which simply confuses risk with probability. In the markets, we are talking about unique, non-repeatable events, so we can't assign a frequency probability to their occurrence. In statistical terminology, such events are categorized under case probability, not class probability. This means the probability of market events is not open to any kind of numerical evaluation. All you can actually determine is the amount of your exposure as opposed to the probability that the market will or will not go to a certain price. Therefore, all you can do is manage your exposure and losses, not predict profits. Money odds versus probability odds. Perhaps the most common fallacy to which market participants are susceptible is money odds versus probability odds. Many market participants express the probability of success in terms of a risk-reward ratio. For example, if I bought my famous takeover stock, which you will hear about in the next chapter, at $26 and placed a sell stop below the market at $23 with an upside objective of $36, my risk-reward ratio would be 3 to 10. Risk $3 to make $10. It is clear that I don't understand probability. Couching my rationalizations in arithmetic terms does not automatically lend credibility to my position. The 3 to 10 ratio has nothing to do with the probability that the stock can or will get to $36. All the ratio does is compare the dollar amount of what I think I might lose to the dollar amount of what I think I might make. But it doesn't say anything about the probability of either event occurring. Some dollars are bigger than others. Why did the dollars seem so big at the blackjack table? Because I was accustomed to dealing with price ticks in the market, not tokens with $25 or $100 printed on them. Ordinarily, the use of chips is a psychological gimmick to minimize the importance of money. And it works on most people. But I was used to handling hundreds of thousands of dollars of market transactions on the simple shout of my voice, which made it seem like money wasn't actually involved. When I had to physically take two $25 chips and throw them onto the blackjack table, it felt like real money. Being down $2,000 in ticks in the market doesn't feel the same as being down $2,000 at the baccarat table. It hurt a lot in baccarat. Also, the $7,000 in baccarat winnings felt like a lot more money than $7,000 in the market. Why? In the pit, I was supposed to be working to try to make that kind of money, but in baccarat, it was like free money. That means spending the $7,000 won in the casino was a lot easier than spending money made in the markets. The night after we'd won all the money, Conrad, Broderick,